Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I'm pleased to welcome back author Matt Richtel to the Tattered Cover. Matt was here for his first technological thriller back in 2007, Hooked. He works as a technological reporter for the New York Times, and last year he won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. That does deserve a round of applause. And it's a little unusual. This is the first time this has ever happened, for me at least, but we got a note from his editor, his publisher, Carl Lennertz. Oh, it says editor, out in New York. And it says, first of all, congratulations on the publication of your fantastic thriller, Devil's Plaything. That's what he's here for tonight. It is pure joy to work with you and your words. I feel like your luckiest reader, but I'm happy to share your book with thousands of others. But I also wanted to thank you for your modesty, grace, and class. One of my favorite moments of watching you in action was at last year's Thriller Fest when Wall Street Journal reporter congratulated you on the Pulitzer Prize. You kind of blushed and said, "Who knew I'd get an award for writing that texting while driving was bad?" But I'm on to something even bigger. I hear cigarettes are bad for you, too. Typical humility and humor. You're the best, Matt, and I've read the draft of your next book, and I'm over the moon, happy, and thrilled. So Matt is here tonight with his newest thriller, a book that mentions our very own Denver quite a bit, Devil's Plaything. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Matt Richtel.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you, Tattered Cover. I'm only pulling out my cell phone so I know what time it is. Also, in a few minutes, just if you guys get bored, we can all take a break and text. So I'm going to start by telling you the funniest thing that I ever heard grandparents say. So this is my paternal grandparents, Marty and Annie, and this is a true story. Now, they are sitting in the front of the car. It's dusk. Marty is driving. Annie's in the passenger seat. It's worth noting that they have a very traditional relationship. They had a very traditional relationship. My grandfather's passed a couple years ago. He's sort of the strong, silent elephant. She is the smaller, ever-moving hummingbird. And so it's dusk, And she looks out the window and she says, "I'm gonna try to do the voices. What's that in the road, Marty?" A little bit gruff. And it's a piece of paper, Anne. She says, "Oh, I thought it was a cat." He says, "No, Annie. You thought it was a man." She says, "Marty, it's too small to be a man." And he says, "Annie, the world's full of small men." So I don't need to deconstruct it too much, but she's saying what she thinks it is. He then proceeds to tell her what she actually thought. She then takes his mind reading on faith and goes with it. And then finally he ends by going completely existential. The world is full of small men. I'm telling this story because my friendship with my grandparents and in part seeded this story. They're both sets of grandparents. The book is dedicated to them. This book has to do in part with a relationship between a grandson and a grandmother. And in this story, the grandmother suffers severe dementia. And I'm going to read you a short passage about that in a second. My own grandmother, far from suffering from dementia, coming up on 94 in 1 week, will kick your tail at online Scrabble. So, and there are actually several people in this audience who can bear witness. So next I'm going to do a very short reading. And the reason it's going to be short is I think these are more fun when we have a conversation. But I want to do a reading to give you a flavor of the book. So this is Devil's Plaything. And on the very first page, it asks this question, or it has a statement and a question. And the statement and the question go like this. The number of people suffering acute memory loss is doubling every 15 years. Shipments of computer memory are doubling every 2 years. Are these two statistics related more than you dare imagine? Now, after that, there's a brief prologue that I'm not going to read you, in which the grandma tells a little bit of her story, and we learn her life story through this book. But then the book starts off with chapter one, the prologue notwithstanding, and that's told from, I mentioned there are two characters in this book, or I didn't mention this, but there are two characters, two protagonists. There's a reporter in San Francisco, a 30-something, and his grandmother, I mentioned, who suffers severe dementia. And this book is written from the perspective of the reporter in the first person. And I'm going to do a truncated version of the first chapter. It goes like this. You can close your eyes and float away if you want, or imagine yourself in Golden Gate Park, drink, whatever helps you get through this. My big toe is exposed and my companion lost in the world beyond. I look down and see my digit poking through the strained fabric at the top of my black canvas high tops. They are worn thin by an opposition to shopping that borders on the pathological and by a paltry freelance journalist income that of late has put shoe upgrades out of reach. Other than my aerated toe, Golden Gate Park is warm, incongruously so given descending darkness. But such is late October in San Francisco, where the seasons are as offbeat and contrarian as the residents. Yeah. Thank you. And good night. So, Grandma Lane, should I get a new pair of shoes or just really thick socks and hope for the quick onset of global warming? I smile at her, but see she's looking off into the distance. Nathaniel, did we see that man earlier? It's a not unexpected non sequitur. My grandmother has dementia. For her, dusk is literal and proverbial, her memory heading quickly into that good night. A month ago, I found her trying to iron her bed linens with a box of Kleenex. She holds tightly to my hand. I feel aging skin pulled loosely over skeleton. What man, Grandma? That one. She points with her free hand over my shoulder. Her continuity surprises me. I turn to look. In the fading light, I see a figure disappear into a thick patch of trees half a football field away. Danger, she says. It's okay, Lane. It's nothing. She stops and looks at me. Let's go home. She's right. It's time to get her back to Magnolia Manor. We've spent the day together for Take Your Grandparents to Work Day. It consisted mostly of a long lunch, a trip to her dentist's office where she refused to get out of the car, and of her watching me interview a pharmaceutical industry executive on the phone for a magazine story I'm writing. And then pistachio ice cream. A day in the life of a medical journalist is boring but filled with snacks. I'm going to move ahead a little bit. We stand on the edge of a wide open grassy spot ringed with majestic eucalyptus trees. Notwithstanding the phantom in the distance, we are alone, the last picnicking lovers having abdicated. Tranquil. The sky overhead is deepening to a gray slate with a distant salmon hue over the west. Maybe one more lap around the grove. And then I hear the distinctive click. Danger. I wrote a story recently about a biotech giant developing better hearing aids by trying to emulate the temporal lobes of experienced soldiers. The finest among the military have a hyper-developed sense of hearing that can pick up the action of a cocking rifle. For the story, I listened to a lot of clicks to see if I could discern the ones that betrayed distant loading rifles. Want to sit on the grass, Grandma? What? I gently pull her to the ground. Maybe there's some weirdo shooting a pellet gun in the dark. A popping noise rips through the dusk a few feet behind us. A tree thuds from impact spraying bark. What the? I yell. A second bullet hits the same tree, and I scramble on top of Grandma, forming a shell. Then in quick succession, pop, 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 pop. Grandma lets out a wild cry. It's okay, I whisper. It's okay. Silence. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. They scramble behind a tree. They get to safety. And then this is just the last little bit of that chapter. I peer past Grandma and through an opening between two eucalyptuses into the open field. Squinting in the poor light, I make out the grove of trees I believe hides one bad person with gun. I see movement, then more rustling, a shape making its way from the grove. I'll be right back, I mutter to Grandma. I might be nuts, but maybe I can get a look at the shooter and play hero with a police department that doesn't much like me these days. A train can't breathe, Grandma mumbles. Stay here, don't move, don't make a sound. It's the man in blue. What? You look tired, Harry, she says. Harry, her friend from the retirement home. Promise me you won't move, I promise. I trudge into the darkness, hoping to get an eyewitness view from a safe distance, wondering how I'll do that, wondering about Grandma. Danger. How did she know? So that's the end of the first chapter. And actually, that's the end of the book. So you've heard it. I've never figured it out, the answer. So here's what I'm going to do. I prefer question and answer. I also know it's hard to get questions and answers going. So what I have done is I have brought you some questions. I will read them. You may choose from among these. You are free to bring your own questions. So here are some of your possible questions. If you don't, I would encourage you to come up with your own. I don't have much of an imagination. Okay. And I really don't know how you think. Okay. Number one question. What sentence that you just read do you really dislike and why? Number two, what's the question from the reading last Thursday in San Francisco that's been plaguing you? You're wondering if I should be paying you all $120 for the hour. Three, will my iPad kill me? Give me a break. Four, you've told us the funniest thing you've heard grandparents say. What's the funniest thing you heard a toddler say today? And five, and finally, how come we don't get to ask any questions? So I'm told that we have a half hour or however from now or however long you're willing to sit, because I will go on and on. So what do you guys think? Did I say one that you guys are interested in, or do you guys want to bring your own?
Question that plaguing you from San Francisco.
Okay, both, yeah. So someone asked about who had read, I had a previous book called Hooked. Some of you have already told me you've read it. The protagonist is called Nat Idle. This is not a sequel. You need not read that. You need not have read that to read this. But someone asked me about the origin of Nat Idle, and I gave an answer that I hadn't really thought about, and the question forced me to think about it. And so I'm going to give you a little bit about this character in a nutshell. Excuse me. And I actually have a feeling I'm going to regret this answer and then try to re-answer Thursday in Boulder. So we'll keep this going. The question that the answer is that I think at his core, this anecdote says something about the protagonist. He went through medical school and he left because he found medical school to be too rote. In a glibber moment, I don't think he means this. There are some doctors in the audience, and I'll just say briefly in praise of doctors, people say laughter's the best medicine. And I say, yes, but don't give up antibiotics. So I don't have anything against doctors, but the character left medical school because it was too rote. Sometimes he felt like he was just diagnosing things without getting into, it was black or white. And in he liked writing and journalism because he likes the really gray areas of the world, the colors, the sides of the box that are murky, and when the box doesn't always, when the numbers don't always add up. That much I know about Nat Idle, but I think what he is going through in each of these books is being peaceful with the idea of living in the gray areas of life. He knows that's where he belongs. He's just not sure how to be totally peaceful with that. In each book, I think in varying degrees, he struggles with that. Is that a better answer than the one I gave that you didn't hear? Okay, good. Yes, go ahead.
So Matt, in your first book, the protagonist was a doctor, or was a medical student.
Yes.
And in this one, he is a medical reporter. And you are married to a doctor, Meredith.
Right.
And so you have some calling. You have some medical calling that you have unresolved.
So when I said before that about the $120 an hour, you know I was kidding. I'm not $250, right? Yes. I don't think so. Actually, I think the truer thing where I am fascinated rather than medicine is psychology and psychiatry. My interest in these characters at their core is about the psychological experiences they go through. And I am trying, I don't know with success, but I am trying to marry hard-driving, irrepressible thrillers with really, I don't want to say deep, but with challenging psychological questions. Where medicine comes in is that it is my feeling when I read these books that when I learn something, and the more a thriller or book that is by its nature fantastical can be rooted in something solid, the more believable it is. And by virtue of having a character who is in medical school, who was in medical school, I get to do two things. One, I get to create a contrast between the psychology I just described, where he's dealing with the gray areas of life and the more black and white ones. And I also get to introduce a knowledge base that makes me get to introduce authenticity amid the fantastical. Does that make sense? Oh, excuse me. The question was, right, because there no, they're podcasting. The question was about whether I have a character who went to medical school and has a medical degree, whether I am working out unresolved, didn't go to medical school issues. No. Yes.
So you write in the New York Times something.
Yes.
Scientific.
Yes.
Does that provide material for your books?
So the question is,
what are you doing at the New York Times?
So the question is, what am I doing at the New York Times, and how does that intersect with this? There's a substantive way they intersect, and there's a creative way they intersect. You want both answers?
Sure.
We have time.
Yes. The thing that I cover at the New York Times is I cover very broadly how technology affects how we behave and how we live. It's been an outgrowth of covering technology broadly for many years, but now I'm looking at questions like, how does heavy computer use affect our behavior? How does it affect how we learn? I'm looking at some questions this year, the first story of which will come out in August that this sounds insincere and glib, but I mean it. I'm not at liberty to say because we're in the middle of a pretty heavy thing. I looked at distracted driving. How does it affect us behind the wheel? All of that stuff from a substantive standpoint informs the fiction because I'm learning not only about the technology. Because science is evolving and emerging, I'm learning about the neurology. I'm learning about the neurochemistry. I'm learning about the physiology. And all of those things lend themselves enormously to your question about giving me some substance. From a creative standpoint, the way fiction, nonfiction and fiction intersect for in an enormous way for me, and it's a long conversation. I won't go into all of it, but I will say that I would wish upon anyone who wants to be a fiction writer a career in journalism for two reasons. The one you probably wouldn't guess, and one you probably will. The one you wouldn't guess is I have become expert, like a lot of journalists, at being at not being a perfectionist. When the New York Times calls you and says, you have 4 hours to get this story done, you learn to write and hit send on the story so it winds up in the next day's paper. As a result, I not only write quickly, but I have learned to live with not being perfect. What slows down, if not paralyzes altogether, many fiction writers and aspiring fiction writers is they write a paragraph and then they stare at it for 17 months. And then they start a new paragraph. So I don't suffer from that. The other way in which I would just say is I'm trained by nature to observe things. And a lot of that stuff doesn't wind up in journalism articles because that's not a medium that suits itself to, you know, the shift in the person's eyes. But you never know what you're going to use. So you're observing everything. So, yes, go ahead. Yes. I should have said that. That's a great question. Almost all the stuff I write for the New York Times is made up. So you can win so many awards. No, I mean, what imperfect means is it's never ever inaccurate. And just to put such a fine point, there's nothing that terrifies me more than the idea of making a mistake in journalism. It's our whole ethos. But that doesn't mean you can't order the paragraphs in different ways. That is an art, not a science. And when I first started in journalism, I worked the night shift, and I couldn't let go of my stories, and I would progressively undress. This is true. I would get so hot. I was sitting at my desk. My shift was supposed to end at 10 p.m., and by 10:30, I would be down to my undershirt and my khakis, my shoes and socks off. I just couldn't let go, and I was but eventually you learn to live. And by the way, now I am often much more dressed. So... Yes, Evan.
You may not be able to answer this. I'm wondering if you could describe your book in 3 words.
Everyone has secrets. Bring it on, Evan.
I see your books developing a bit of a worldview about the negative impact of technology on users, and where do you think you're going with that?
Is that
a worldview, or is that
okay? That's an okay question. So my father-in-law asks, My father-in-law asks a great question. He says, these books appear to have even almost a Luddite quality, questioning the value of technology. Is that my worldview, and where are they ultimately going? I want to give two answers. One is, I do not have an anti-technology view. This has provided me fodder for in an area that I have some knowledge. And they do say, write what you know, and I'm writing what I know. And I do also think there is more to be said about that topic. But my worldview is not anti-technology, and I don't imagine all my books will, should I have the privilege of a muse visiting, will have that message. But I also want to say something else that is truly heartfelt. These books are not about technology for or against. That is the canvas on which I'm drawing these. I don't know if the picture that I'm trying to draw is coming through, but it is much more about relationships and love and longing and loss and all the things that you hear or imagine fiction writers write about. Technology is a backdrop that's given me some opportunity. It's a kind of modern lubricant, if you will. But the questions that I'm interested in are age old. And at each one of these stories, my character is evolving as he goes through different stages of life and coping with those different stages and learning about himself through those stages. If I do what I'm trying to do, I don't know if I am, but if I do what I'm trying to do, you walk away from these feeling something much more about the characters than you do about the computers. But, you know, that is my burden. It's at least what I'm intending. So, yeah, go ahead.
So I think I know this because I read your Facebook posting, but tell us the funniest thing that a toddler said to you.
Okay, all right, here's the funniest thing a toddler ever said. So this is Milo. He'll be 3 in September. This is this morning. He's walking around the living room of my in-law's place, and he kind of, his foot hits a little Fisher-Price cell phone, which causes it to ring. He picks it up. He puts it to the side of his head. He says, hello. And then he goes, let me call you back from a landline. Yeah. Someone put on Facebook, his Fisher-Price must have had AT&T service. You cannot make it up. Yeah. Thank you for... I wanted to say that. I'm glad you... Listen, I want to say it's about 8:15 when they asked me to stop. You guys have been great. I'm going to applaud for you guys. I'm going to sign some books. I will also say, I try to be personal with these. There's a lot of folks tonight. If you want something personal, I may sign it later, or I may just sign tonight. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.